Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Welcome to If You Love This Planet. My special guest today is Professor Richard Falk. He is the Albert G. Milbank Professor of International Law Emeritus at Princeton University, where he was a member of the faculty for 40 years until 2001. Richard Falk is currently Research Professor at the Santa Barbara campus of the University of California, where he directs a research program on climate change, human security, and democracy. Professor Falk has been the Special Rapporteur on Occupied Palestine for the United Nations Human Rights Council since 2008. He served as chair of the board of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation from 2004 to 2012, and in 2008 to 2009, he was appointed expert advisor to the President of the United Nations General Assembly. He's an honorary editor of the American Journal of International Law and a member of the International Advisory Editorial Boards of Third World Quarterly and Globalizations. Professor Falk has published more than 50 books, including his most recent, published in 2012, titled Path to Zero, Dialogue on Nuclear Dangers. Professor Richard Falk, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Thank you very much. Happy to be with you.
I want to start on a personal note, Richard. Do you recall how we first met? Would you like to tell the audience just a little bit of a vignette?
I hope we have the same memory, but my recollection is that you came and gave a brilliant talk at Princeton, where I was then teaching, and we spent some time together afterwards.
I remember.
Did that correspond with
yes,
your
yes,
recollection?
Yes, and your then wife Florence said she'll never forget because I sat at the conference at Princeton when I wasn't speaking doing my knitting, and that was very funny, she thought. And then and then I stayed in your house, which was full of giraffes, if I remember rightly. Is that right?
That is quite right. I still have been sticking my neck out too long.
And your two dear little boys, what were their names?
Dimitri and Noah.
Yeah. And we talked a lot about tennis because your mother was a great tennis player and I love tennis. And you're a great player, Richard.
Well, I get by.
Well, I hear you're still playing tennis.
Yes, that's true.
Well, now, let's get stuck into the issues. We're going to talk a lot about the Middle East. And you started with your topics that you would like to discuss, the Arab Spring 1 year later, with some sense of the good, Tunisia, and the bad, Syria, Libya, Bahrain, and the in-between, Egypt, Yemen, and Morocco. Let's first talk about Tunisia, Richard, and the initiation of the Arab Spring there. What happened, and why was it good?
Well, it was quite an extraordinary, unexpected development in a country that had been governed in a very tyrannical and corrupt manner for several decades. It started when in an isolated Tunisian town, when a young street vendor, Mohamed Bouazizi, set himself on fire because of his sense, I suppose, of both hopelessness and bitterness about the manner in which he had been treated. And this was a spark that obviously ignited passions that had been simmering below the surface in Tunisia and led to the uprising that spread throughout the country and induced the ruler to escape and to, in effect, turn the country over to the popular forces that had staged this revolution, which then spread elsewhere, most notably to nearby Egypt.
And it was a peaceful revolution, wasn't it, Richard?
Yes, it was completely peaceful, completely indigenous, internal, no external interference, and it was something that really did create a great deal of amazement, I think, because the Arab world had been written off as a place where the population was passive, and if it acted, it only acted violently. So all these Western stereotypes were shattered by the way in which the Tunisian revolution evolved and occurred and is continuing to evolve.
Mm. Okay, so then let's move on to Egypt. What happened there? And we need you to talk about the evolution of that and bring us up to date to where it stands now, Richard Falk.
Well, Egypt is a more complex story that is unfolding in a rather dramatic way, even as we speak. I've been there to Cairo each of the last 2 years, shortly after Tahrir Square and about 2 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
When I was there a year ago, there was a very pervasive sense of excitement, a feeling that a historic transformation had taken place. And although people didn't know what exactly was coming next, they had a feeling that the developments, the mass uprising that had occurred, was mainly nonviolent, not as nonviolent as what had occurred in Tunisia. Some 800 or so people had been killed in the course of the demonstrations that lasted over a period, very intense demonstrations of 18 days. There was a feeling of uncertainty a year ago about how much the army was needed and trusted, and both things were important. There was a realization that the army was providing a kind of order for the society, but there was concern that maybe the army was not really ready to do more than get rid of the leader, Mubarak, who had been overthrown by the events. A year later, it is now much more, there's a much more skeptical attitude. There's still a kind of sense that it was good to get rid of the dictator who had lasted 30 years, but there was a feeling that the army was probably not prepared to give up its stranglehold over the society, that it also had a big stake in the economy that it didn't want to jeopardize by allowing real democracy to flourish. And yet there was an attempt to give way to the expectations of the popular revolution. And so there have been parliamentary elections, and next week there will be a presidential election that is probably quite important. The other development that I think probably has caused mainly concern on the part of most Egyptians, but also maybe hope on the part of others, and that is the surprisingly strong showing of the Islamic political parties in the parliamentary elections.
Mm.
And now the presidential election, which is a complicated story that I won't try to relate, has been narrowed down after a first round of voting to a candidate from the Muslim Brotherhood named Mohamed Morsi, and the last prime minister in the Mubarak government, Ahmed Shafiq, who comes with a kind of law and order, almost counter-revolutionary program. So you have an unfortunate choice for the Egyptian people.
And they're not happy, are they? They've got either someone still representing the military in the old regime, or the Muslim Brotherhood, which could convert Egypt into an Islamic fundamentalist state, basically.
Yes, I don't. I think that danger may be exaggerated. I think the Muslim Brotherhood will probably, if it succeeds, strike some kind of deal with the military and will superficially move in an Islamic direction, but I don't think it will. I don't think it is itself fundamentalist, unlike the other Islamic tendencies in Egypt, which are like the Salafis that did very well in the parliamentary elections, and their presidential candidate was disqualified. He might actually have been the most popular in the voting. So it's a confusing and complicated situation.
It is, and I remember reading, you know, when the whole Egyptian revolution began, that the military, as well as being in total control of the state, runs most of the economy and the production facilities and the like, and the food distribution and everything. Is that right?
Yeah. I wouldn't say most of the economy, but maybe the estimates are 30%, 35%, but that's very significant. And they do, they're in all kinds of private sector businesses, like sale of bottled water and some kitchen utilities, things you don't really associate with the defense of the country.
That's really creepy, Richard, I think.
Yes, it's not, but in fairness, it's not limited to Egypt. It's true for quite a few countries in the global south.
But the other thing is that, you know, America gives Israel $3.1 billion a year and has for years, but it also, to be even-handed, always gave Egypt about the same amount per year, which Mubarak spent on military equipment and the like, and I guess suppressing his people. Does America still give Egypt as much money as that now?
It doesn't give Egypt that much money. It gives it, I think, something over $1 billion per year, and mainly to the military.
Yeah, so they've cut
back.
So
it really isn't very useful in restoring normalcy to the Egyptian economy, which has suffered a great deal since the revolutionary happenings of 2011.
Then Israel's really worried, isn't it? Because if the Muslim Brotherhood wins, which it could well, they're worried about the relationship with Egypt now, and because Mubarak totally supported Israel, what would happen, do you think, Richard Falk?
It's hard to say, Helen. It's very difficult to say. I think that the Muslim Brotherhood would make some gestures in the direction of revising the peace treaty that had been signed during the Sadat period in the late 1970s.
With Israel, yes.
With Israel. And what is also true is that the public in all these countries views the Palestinian struggle as a symbolic struggle for justice.
Yeah.
And therefore, any leadership, the more democratic it would, the more it would reflect public opinion, the more likely it would be to take a much more critical stance toward Israel. there's no question that the Palestinian movement at this point throughout the Arab world has much the same moral position as the anti-apartheid movement,
yes,
in relation to South Africa did in the 1980s and 90s.
Well, why is Israel so horrible to the Palestinians, Richard, in every way? What is that dynamic?
Well, I think the essential dynamic is that Israel has, as a settler kind of society, has had the will and the capabilities to suppress the indigenous Palestinian population and to gradually encroach upon their portion of historic Palestine, which had originally been divided between the claims to establish a Jewish state and the indigenous Palestinian population. Back after World War I, the British Foreign Secretary, Lord Balfour, had promised the Jews a homeland to be established in Palestine, but not at the expense of the people living there.
Mm-hmm.
This was a colonial promise, of course.
Yeah.
Balfour had no real authority to override the self-determination of the people in Palestine.
Right.
But it was the kind of way these issues were handled at that time. And then after World War II, the British, which had administered Palestine as a mandate, were confronted by this conflict there, which they didn't know how to resolve. So they put the issue in the lap of the new United Nations, which recommended a partition of historic Palestine, giving 55% to Israel and 45% to the Palestinians. This seemed unfair at the time from the Arab and Palestinian point of view, and the War of Independence in 1948 resulted in Israel gaining even more of historic Palestine, really reducing the territory of Palestine to its 1967 borders, which left the Palestinians with only 22%.
Oh, goodness me.
And then since 1967, in those 45 years, Israel has gradually encroached on that 22%. Building the 100 settlements that have about 500,000 Israelis living in them.
Half a million.
And a whole scattering of outposts that are occupied by or lived in by settlers, but are not lawful under Israeli law. And so they have a kind of ambiguous status. But the main point is that in relation to both Jerusalem and this remnant of historic Palestine, Israel has tried to encroach upon as much of the its historic biblical claim as it could, and the Palestinians have naturally resisted this. That has led to the confrontation and the absence of any real prospect of a peace in the foreseeable future, I think.
Well, what I don't understand, Richard, I'm interviewing Richard Falk, who's the Albert G. Milbank Professor of International Law Emeritus at Princeton University. What I don't understand, Richard, is after what the Jews went through in the Second World War, how they were incredibly abused and how they have been discriminated against for almost ever. How, why, and they're highly intelligent people on the whole, why haven't they learnt from their own history to treat another people's in a way that they wish they'd been treated. Why? Is it because the abused abuse? Is that what it is, do you think?
Well, I it's a very fundamental question, Helen, and I think there's no one answer that is satisfactory. I think you're right that there are many examples historically of those to whom evil has been done do evil in return. And the Israelis particularly feel that the suffering and persecution that they endured during the Holocaust gives them a free hand to address their security concerns in any way they wish. Then, of course, they have the narrative that the Arabs are intent on throwing them into the sea, and a second, the prospect is portrayed of a second Holocaust that will...
Is that so? Do they talk about
it? No, it's not. It's a useful myth.
Myth.
It probably was never so, and certainly for decades has not represented any serious Arab intentions and isn't what the Palestinians seek.
Yes.
I think there's another important aspect of this, and that is that the sense of Jewish victimization has created the impression among the majority of Israelis that when Israel acts passively and weakly, they are abused. And when they act with force and violence, they are respected. And this is reinforced by a kind of cultural stereotype that the only language that the Arab people understand is the language of force. Again, this is a useful myth that doesn't correspond with reality.
All right, well, I'm interviewing Richard Falk, who was a professor of international law emeritus at Princeton University. Richard, let's move on to Libya, because I'm very fascinated by Libya. I've been in contact with a man called Michel Chazadovsky, who I'm sure you know about, in Montreal. And his take on Libya is different from what I ever read in the traditional newspapers or the media, and that was that China had quite a big stake in the oil in Libya, and Libya has a huge amount of oil. Gaddafi, while being a dictator, it's also true that he brought in a lot of African people into Libya, who were treated equally, that women had pretty well equal rights with men as opposed to many Arab countries, and that way back the two countries in the Middle East that had the highest rate of literacy and the lowest infant mortality, which are very good social indicators of a society, were in fact Iraq and Libya. And so although Gaddafi got a bit madder as he got older and was a dictator, in fact, his country was pretty well settled. And the story that Chazadovsky talks about is that the uprising was probably fomented by actually NATO. And then when you look at what actually happened, NATO came in with its blasted aeroplanes and bombed the hell out of cities and killed a huge number of people. And then in a most disgraceful way, orchestrated the killing of Gaddafi, which was disgusting, the way they did with Hussein. And I'd like your take on that, on that picture, Richard. Where do you stand on all of this historically?
Well, I think that that this kind of counter-narrative that emphasizes oil geopolitics is something that should be taken seriously and investigated. I don't have the knowledge of the specific reality in Libya to make a real judgment about that. I do think that it's noticeable that where the oil reserves are, if the government turns hostile to the West, there's a much greater likelihood of
invasion,
coercive responses, yep, and military intervention.
Like Iraq.
And, yes. And one can say that the reluctance to do much to help the Syrian people is probably connected with the absence of oil. That and the acceptance of a fundamentalist regime in Saudi Arabia or Bahrain has to do
with
it
oil
being friendly to the West.
I know, it makes me sick. You know, Saudi Arabia is one of the most repressive regimes in the world. It's disgusting towards women. You know, if a woman's had an affair with someone, they bury her in stone ahead, you know. Or if a woman's found driving
terrible.
A car, you know, she's put in jail.
I can't stand it.
And
it's so hypocritical.
No, the hypocrisy.
Complain about the treatment of women in Iran, for instance,
yeah,
which is not perfect by any means, but compared to Saudi Arabia, it's like a utopia.
Like night and day. Saudi Arabia,
yeah.
It's almost beyond compare what they're doing. And then in Bahrain, where the people want to rise up, guess what? America's got the biggest naval base in the Middle East in Bahrain. So guess what they're doing to the people rising up, like in Egypt and like in Tunisia? They're killing them. And
yes,
with the help of Saudi Arabia, who's coming in. Now, who's behind that? America.
Yes, and that's the second thing. I mean, oil is one factor that's never discussed, but is very much, I think, part of the explanation of where intervention takes place and where it doesn't. And military bases are the other largely suppressed explanation of what is happening and what is not happening in the region.
Yeah. Okay, so let's move on to Syria. So the story that Shazadovsky's talking about too is that Russia has a big military base in Syria and has big interests there, and that much of the uprising, I know there are tribes like the Alawites, which are a minority and to which Assad belongs, and they're the ruling party. They're resented by others, number one, and they're hanging on to power. Number two, it's been many people in Syria still support the regime because it's been a fairly stable regime. Number three, that the uprisings are fomented to a degree, again, by not NATO per se, but the American intelligence agencies and the like. And he's got a lot of evidence to show that this is going on, Richard. What's your take about Syria?
Well, again, I think that the ethos of suspicion is justified from what I know, which is not sufficient to make a conclusive assessment.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think even in Libya, the situation, the counter-narrative is insightful and illuminating, but it's not the whole story.
Yeah, of course, it's complex.
There are spontaneous elements in the uprising against both Gaddafi and Assad. And
of course, people can be co-opted as well, you know, by, you look at the weapons they've got. In Egypt, there were no weapons. In Tunisia, there were no weapons. But in Libya and Syria, people are running around with the most sophisticated weapons and in army uniforms, I'm sure supplied by the West. I mean, where are they getting them from?
Yes, and the geopolitical element is also important, I don't know how to pronounce his name. I know who he is.
Shazadovsky.
Shazadovsky,
yeah.
I mean, I think it is true that the fact that Russia stands to benefit from the stability of the Assad regime because it has these large military sales and the base that you mentioned, and that China was involved with Libya. I think so. You have this geopolitical level of engagement. You have the oil dimension and the military base dimension, and it's rather shocking that the media in these democratic societies around the world don't give appropriate attention to those aspects, and therefore the public doesn't really have access to the true factors that work in these conflict situations.
There's no investigative reportage that should be taking place, and it seems like even the New York Times, well, you know, it helped to instigate the war in Iraq, so it's not a shining example of purity, but even the New York Times is not doing its work, and it's become sycophantal to Hillary Clinton and the State Department. You know, I
would say especially the New York Times.
That
the New York Times has for a long time, particularly in the Middle East, been an extension of U.S. foreign security policy.
Why, Richard? Why?
Well, there are various views. One is that in order to retain its access to the most important information coming from the government, that it needs to be seen as responsive to the priorities of foreign policy.
Of the U.S. government, yep.
Of the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. And then it has pursued over the years a position that is biased in favor of Israel.
Oh, yes. And, the Israeli lobby has such power in America. I mean, people are too scared to speak up against it because they're accused of being anti-Semitic. Well, that's ridiculous. That's ridiculous.
Yes, but it's used effectively by the Zionist movement as a way of intimidating criticism.
I know.
And it's been alarmingly effective. It's also been extended in recent years, I don't know if this is true in Australia, but here to university people who are critical of Israel, they are threatened in their careers and often have unreasonable difficulties getting tenure or promotions or even retaining their academic positions.
Well, Richard, has that ever happened to you? You're Jewish and you've been...
I was harder to attack than many people because I did do a lot of writing on other subjects, and I hadn't been involved with the Israel-Palestine conflict until maybe 25 years ago, and so I was already reasonably established by that time. So I've been attacked a lot, but I haven't really had difficulties with the academic institutions I've been associated with.
No. Now, Richard, I'm interviewing Richard Falk, who's the Albert G. Milbach Professor of International Law Emeritus at Princeton University. I'd like to talk about Yemen. I really don't know much about Yemen and what's going on there. Can you fill us in on that, please?
Well, Yemen is complicated and unresolved. There is definitely an extension of the happenings in Tunisia and Egypt. A dictator was long in power in Yemen and was eventually persuaded to step down, but ambiguously whether he really gave up power or not. It's a very interesting case because the U.S. involvement can be interpreted either way, either as pushing Saleh out as dictator or as basically wanting to hold on to a status quo, because there are elements of al-Qaeda and anti-American extremism that are situated in Yemen. While he was dictator, he allowed drone strikes and special forces to operate within his country. So there was this sense on the one side of trying not to be seen as blocking a democratizing revolution, but at the same time, Washington didn't want to lose its security foothold in Yemen. Of course, Yemen doesn't have oil, and there's no Chinese and Russian factors of the sort that we've been discussing in Syria and Libya.
Mm-hmm. But he was attacking al-Qaeda in his country and allowing the Americans to use drones to do that.
Yes.
Okay, so that's complex in itself. Now, what about Morocco, Richard Falk?
Well, Morocco is a monarchy where the king has been trying to portray his rule as basically reformist, basically sympathetic with the demands of the population. It's a monarchy that also has religious authority, because the king is supposed to be in some way descended from Mohammed.
Oh.
And the population is more accepting of this kind of governing process. But there is a lot of unrest. There's extreme disparity between the rich elite
and the poor.
And the massive poverty of the most Moroccans. There's a feeling that the king's promises are not really serious and being fulfilled.
Mm.
And so it's unclear what will happen in Morocco. It's an important country. It has important resources.
What resources does it have?
Well, the most famous one, the most prominent ones are phosphates, which are essential for all kinds of industrial and agricultural purposes.
Yes, fertilizer.
Yes, and something like 90% of the world's output.
Oh, really?
So it's important. It also has this unresolved internal problem that has to do with the self-determination movement on its eastern border that hasn't been resolved.
Right. Okay, now, you've just been in Istanbul, Richard, and so have I, and you said you had a fascinating trip to Istanbul. Tell us about that, because I'd like to compare experiences.
Well, I was there for a conference organized by the UN Alliance of Civilizations, and it focused on a vision of politics that is emerging in the Islamic world, and how that contrasts with the Western ideas of development and governance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there were some very interesting participants, including Mr. Ghannouchi, who's the sort of visionary leader in Tunisia. And he gave a very clear and articulate view of his hopes for the democratic transformation that's going on there.
Mm.
He happened to be in the same part of the program as I was, and there was a very good range of participation, and one had this sense of trying to both understand the developments in the region, but also this continuing concern about the rise of Islamophobia in different parts of the world, particularly in Europe, and a worry that the hypothesis associated with Bernard Lewis and Samuel Huntington about a clash of civilizations, that that was really being enacted by reactionary forces in the West and leading to horrible incidents like the Breivik murder of the children on the island in Norway.
Oh, that was dreadful.
A few months ago.
Yes, yes. Well,
and all of that, I mean, that those incidents are made more likely to take place in a climate of hostility to Islam that has been opportunistically manipulated by political politicians throughout the West.
And really initiated by the 9/11 incident, which Cheney et al., Rumsfeld used to their advantage to really initiate this anti-Islamic feeling, don't you think? Do you think it stems from there, Richard?
Yeah, it certainly played a part. I think, in fairness to them, they did try to separate the response to 9/11 from the characterization of Islam as a religion. But what? But their base, their political base, which included the evangelical Christians, they didn't make that distinction, and they encouraged a view that Islamic religion was itself the source of extremism and violence, and that it was really a religion that nurtured the kind of terrorism that the 9/11 attacks occurred, illustrated.
Yeah, it seems like a country always has to have an enemy, and now that the Soviet Union's gone, you know, you've got to conjure up another one, and this is a convenient one at this particular point in history.
Yes, I think there's no question that there were there was a kind of depression in the Pentagon after the Berlin Wall fell.
Because they had no enemy. Jesus, they give me the dry rot.
So they tried to invent, you know, they first regarded Japan as their enemy.
Yeah.
And when that didn't seem credible, they shifted in the direction of Islam and to some extent China.
Oh, yeah.
And it is unfortunate that it's not only that the political culture seems to need an enemy, but to justify the incredible military budget during a time of supposed fiscal difficulty requires some plausible security justification. As you know, the U.S. spends almost as much as the world put together on its military machine.
On killing.
And it's never felt more insecure as a country. It shows the disparity between military capabilities and genuine human security.
I know. I was in Turkey too, and I was at a conference that they organized on nuclear power. I was one of the few people who spoke against it because Turkey's interested in building new reactors, and that was pretty scary. What is the relationship with America? They've got American nuclear weapons based there, and they're trying to intervene in Syria. I don't know if I totally trust Turkey, Richard, with its past history.
Well, I think the situation in Turkey is complex because on the one side, you have a very strong developmental enthusiasm, and I think the reactors are part of Turkey's idea that it's becoming a great country, and to be a great country, it needs energy independence and most advanced technology. I think it is, as you say, remarkably uncritical about the dangers of nuclear power and seems not to have noticed what happened in Fukushima at all. And that's discouraging. As far as Syria is concerned, I think Turkey did try for a long time to have a normal relationship with the Assad government. In fact, it promoted a more cooperative relationship. And when the uprisings began, it encouraged very strongly the Assad government to make appropriate reforms, and they used their diplomatic leverage for quite a long time to move in that direction. But they have taken a consistent principled position that they will never support a government that kills its own people and that engages in violence against its own people.
Yeah.
As always, there are other factors involved. Assad represented the Alawite Shia tendencies in Islam. Turkey is strongly associated with the Sunni alternative to that. I think Turkey would be more comfortable with a Sunni leadership in Syria, given these developments that have occurred in the last year or so.
Richard, do you think that these dreadful massacres in Hula and the one yesterday that killed 68 people, many of them children, do you really think it's the security forces under Assad that are actually doing this? Or do you think that there are other elements, you know, anti-government elements who are just as horrible who are involved? What's your take?
Well, as far as I know, the Hula massacre was carried out by this militia that is considered by most trusted observers to be very much under the control of the Assad government. Now, the other incidents, I think, are more questionable, and there's every reason to think that the opposition to the Assad government has no higher moral scruples than does the Damascus regime.
So it's a pox.
But again, it's a black box, largely, and very difficult to get an understanding of what's really happening or who is responsible for what.
A pox on both houses. It turns my blood cold. In going back to Turkey, of course, Turkey got a hell of a fallout from Chernobyl. And I'm very careful when I go into organic food shops, health food shops, quote unquote, to ask if their dried apricots, dried tomatoes and the like come from Turkey, because Turkey got so much fallout from Chernobyl, their tea was very radioactive, and they picked it all and sent it back to Russia because they were so annoyed with the Russians. But a lot of their food is still radioactive, and I tell people not to buy any Turkish food at all, and they're still aware of that, you know, and they're such an agrarian society. It's so tragic.
Yeah, it is tragic, and the fruit and vegetables are so good.
Oh,
actually,
they're lovely, yes. Now, just quickly, because we've only got a little time left, do you think that America's going to sanction Israel bombing Iran?
Well, I think that they certainly will not oppose it openly if it happens. Because it would be such a disaster from the point of view of the world economy, regional stability, and possible unforeseen spread of violence, that I would hope and even suppose that the U.S. will try to discourage Israel from taking such action, and will try to convince Israel that its coercive diplomacy by way of sanctions and special operations. You know, it's interfered, it's killed scientists in Iran.
It has.
I mean, it's allowed Israel Mossad to do that, and it's used these computer worms to disrupt the operations of the nuclear program. So I am still generally feel that the disaster of a war initiated by an Israeli attack will not happen. But it's with the Netanyahu leadership in Israel and the way it has been threatening to launch an attack, it's not clear. And, of course, Iran facing such threats and such interventions that have already occurred might at some point do something understandable in retaliation, and that could easily lead to an attack, even though it wasn't the intended scenario.
Mm.
So it's a very precarious and dangerous situation.
Even though the IAEA says that there's no evidence that they've got bombs, and the 16 intelligence agencies in America say the same thing. You know, physicians for social...
No, the 16 intelligence agencies go further. They say that all the evidence points to the fact that Iran abandoned any military program back in 2003, I believe it is.
Three or four.
And
yeah,
that there's no evidence that they've resumed it since then.
Unbelievable. And
it's unbelievable that a president like Obama doesn't have the sense of political freedom that would allow him to take account of that in public. He acts as though there's no doubt that Iran is seeking nuclear weapons, and therefore we have to impose these sanctions to prevent them from doing it. It's a completely fictitious scenario that is being played out in this very lethal way that punishes the people of Iran.
Well, I don't really trust Obama now after his kill conferences with drones that have been going on since he's been in there, and he's killing wedding parties, and then he kills so-called terrorists, and then he'll go and kill the funeral of the terrorists because all the friends of the terrorists are probably terrorists themselves. You know, this is pretty. And the New York Times broke that story.
Yes, it is a depressing time, and this technology is very menacing in terms of the future. It's spreading around. 50 countries now have drones.
Do they really?
And
has America sold them drones?
Obviously, what is what one does to others will be done to oneself at some point.
That's right. Did America sell those 50 countries drones, Richard Falk?
Not only there are other countries that are engaged in the development of drones, including Israel, and Israel has supplied drones and trained their crews, including Turkey, ironically enough.
And, you know, Physicians for Social Responsibility did a study a few years ago to say that if three nuclear weapons were dropped on the two uranium facilities at Nahant and Isfahan, uranium enrichment facilities, and they couldn't be destroyed but with nuclear weapons because the bunker busters don't get deep enough, that the resulting fallout from the uranium that would be volatilized and vaporized and the fallout from the nuclear weapons could kill 2.6 million people in the first 48 hours all the way over to Afghanistan, India and Pakistan.
It's horrible.
Horrible, Richard. Horrible. You know, it's funny because when you read the analyses in the Washington Post and the New York Times and all the rest about, you know, should Israel do this and will Obama do that, and no one ever talks about people dying.
Yes, it's true. And I mean, there's no perception of the civilian suffering that is caused by the drones aside from the people that die. the fact that if you live in these parts of the world and you never know when something is going to emerge out of the sky and destroy your home or your community, it must induce a kind of terror, sense of terror.
Yes. What were Hitler's bombs called when they went over London and they never knew when the noise stopped overhead if the bomb would land on? Were they Beetle bombs, or I can't remember the names of those.
I can't remember. I remember what you're referring to.
And the terror that invoked all those years ago. Ah, well, Richard, look, thanks for an absolutely fascinating discussion. You're such an...
Well, it's wonderful to talk with you. I wish you were here in person and hope you will be before too long.
All right, my love. Thank you very much, Richard, and I really appreciate it, and I hope to see you soon.
Good. Thank you, Helen.
My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Professor Richard Falk, author and research professor at the Santa Barbara campus of the University of California, and also the Albert G. Milbank Professor of International Law Emeritus at Princeton University. Fascinating discussion, wouldn't you say? Everybody should listen. On that note, if you would like to contribute to this very important radio show, please go to our website at ifyoulovethisplanet.org and press the donate button now. And please help us to stay on air. It's very, very, very important. There are so few programs like this where we can talk about absolutely anything that we need to talk about without any editing inhibitions. I thank you so much for listening, and we'll have another fascinating program for you next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.